Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, California's high-speed rail project is facing new turmoil with the departure of its current CEO and more questions about the future of the rail line. We'll talk to the Fresno Bee's Tim Sheehan, who's been covering the story. We'll also learn why a major international counterculture festival is giving a big boost to kids in the small Kern County city of Arvin, and how avocado growers are hoping the San Joaquin Valley might be the perfect place to quench America's desire for more guacamole. Plus, jazz artist Donnie McCaslin on his collaboration with the late rock star David Bowie and his performance at this weekend's Bakersfield Jazz Festival. That's all coming up later in our show. We begin, though, with the latest on a story that brought the San Joaquin Valley into the national news a week ago, a murder spree that left four men dead and many asking questions about how this could have happened. It began on the night of April 13th with the shooting death of a security guard at a Motel 6 on Fresno's Blackstone Avenue. Then exactly a week ago, shortly before 9 a.m., Fresno police released the name of a suspect in that case, Corey Muhammad. Later that day, police allege Muhammad went on a shooting spree in downtown Fresno, killing a PG&E worker and two clients of Catholic Charities before police took Muhammad into custody. The shootings appear to be random, but all of the victims were white males. We now know a lot more about the alleged killer and what may have sparked this crime spree, which police are calling not terrorism, but an act of hate. Here to tell us more is FM 89's Jeffrey Hess, who has been covering the story for the last week for this station and for NPR. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you.
So what do we know about Corey Muhammad?
Well, he's 39 years old. He's black male. He's originally from Fresno, although he's previously lived some time in Sacramento as well before moving back here. Kind of bouncing between jobs. It doesn't seem that he had a wife or any children, so he was apparently single. And at the time, just kind of an average guy just living his life, a brief criminal record. But other than that, nothing that would have tipped off that he was planning what appears to be a mass murder spree in downtown.
Was he known to authorities? Was he somebody that they frequently interact with as far as gang issues or things like that?
He claims to have been part of a gang. The police have not been clear if it was a previous affiliation or if he was currently affiliated. He does have a criminal record, mostly involving drugs. But the last arrest I could find from him was more than a decade ago. So it's not something that it doesn't appear that he was currently involved in what you would consider to be like a criminal lifestyle.
So walk us through exactly what happened Tuesday mid-morning last week.
Right. So I do want to touch on one thing first about the terrorism angle, because there was a lot of concern when this first happened because he apparently yelled Allah Akbar when he was arrested, which is it means God is great in Arabic. It's a common phrase for terrorists, and that set off a lot of alarm bells. But last week when we were updated, Chief Dyer gave us a more clear picture of who he was and his religious background.
He stayed in a ravine Friday through Sunday, where he practiced what was described to him as voodoo rituals. He said he is Muslim, but prays to seven different gods and described one of his gods as Aguna.
So that sort of, it doesn't clear up the picture, but it does kind of take religion off the table as far as his motivation for launching the attack.
So walk us through in more detail how this played out on Tuesday.
So between the shooting at the motel on Thursday and the shooting on Tuesday, he was in hiding. As you heard, he was hiding in a ravine, so he had no access to any type of information. Tuesday morning, he went to a Starbucks, got on Wi-Fi, and found out that he was a suspect. And at that point, he decided, I'm not going to go down just on this security guard alone. I'm going to take out as many white men, specifically white men, as he can. Now, he spoke with the television station CBS 47 over the weekend, and in his own words, he said, I was actually going to turn myself in. Then I started thinking about the missing black women and children, started thinking about Flint, Michigan, started thinking about crack cocaine epidemic, started thinking about injustices and atrocities my people go through, and that's why I snapped. And then Chief Dyer, who I ran into again last week, and I mentioned, you know, I've covered a lot of crime stories, and this is one of the more bizarre that I've ever been a part of, and he kind of smiled and said, you don't even know the half of it. Like, there's only so much we can tell you. There's so much more going on. And he alluded to that in the press conference yesterday or last week when he really laid out the full timeline.
Corey Muhammad is not a terrorist, but he is a racist. And he's filled with hate, and he set out this past week to kill as many people as he possibly could.
And again, quoting from the CBS 47 interview, he said, I gave my life for the freedom of my people, the ultimate freedom of my people. He was in court on Friday. He was yelling out things saying, let black people go with reparations. So it's very unusual for a suspect to walk police step by step through everything that happened. It's very unusual for a suspect to be yelling out things in court and seeming to be completely remorseless for killing four people. And it's even more unusual for them to give an interview from jail to a television station about the crimes and just absolutely seeming to admit it and taking no remorse or regret for anything that happened.
So Muhammad is accused of approaching a PG&E worker in a truck near downtown Fresno, Venice, and Divisadero neighborhood, shooting him, going on to shoot two more a short distance away. But police brought this under control relatively quickly. How did the whole scene wind down?
So police responded within minutes because of the shot spotter system, which heard the gunshots. As soon as he saw a police officer, he completely gave himself up. He put up no resistance at all. He didn't try to run. And he says he did this because he wanted to show that he was courageous and that he wasn't a terrorist, because terrorists often kill themselves when they commit these crimes. But he wanted to show that he had this strength of conviction, again, saying that he gave up his freedom for his people and that he respected the officers, which is a kind of an odd thing to say. He said he didn't want to put the officer in the position of having to shoot him. He didn't want to put an officer in a position of having to make a decision like that. So as soon as he saw a police officer, he threw himself on the ground and gave himself up without resistance.
Chief Dyer was there shortly thereafter. I understand he had an exchange with the suspect.
That's news to me.
Yeah. So Chief Dyer said that he told him, sorry, Chief, and that went on. And eventually the suspect took the officers on a tour of the crime scene.
Yeah. This was obviously after the media had dispersed. But in that evening of this shooting, they went step by step by step through everything that happened. He showed them where he dumped the shell casings from reloading his weapon. He showed him everything, and the chief said that he laughed while it was happening.
The one thing the police don't have is the alleged murder weapon. What's the status of that?
So this is a little strange. Apparently, he ran into a complete stranger after having fired all but one of the 18 rounds that he had. They had some kind of interaction, and Muhammad gave this man the weapon, and the man left. And police have not been able to find him yet, and they don't know who he is. My guess is Muhammad doesn't know who he is because, I mean, he probably just ran into an absolute stranger. There are a couple people that survived all of this. There was a second security guard at the motel that was shot at but survived. There was another white man that was shot at in downtown Fresno, but he missed and he survived as well. And there was a Hispanic woman and her children in a car where Muhammad fired one shot at them before he realized that they weren't white men. And that's the only part that he says regrets. He regrets. He says, the only regret I have is because of the woman and the child in the car. I'm glad I did not hit them. I probably couldn't live with myself if I hit the woman and the child. I had no intention of hurting women and children, but was very well intended on killing white men.
Do we know any more about what fueled this hate that he has?
It's difficult to tell. When someone is professing to have rather unusual religious beliefs and has a track record on social media of posting incendiary comments and not backing down from them, the defense has asked for and been granted a psychiatric evaluation of him. So even his defense thinks that there might not be something completely right. I mean, obviously, if you go on this kind of rampage, there's probably not something completely right with you. But to draw a line from one point to another, it's difficult. He just hated white people and If he figured he was going to jail, he was taking as many with him as he could.
So the FBI and the federal government were involved from the outset once this shooting spree happened last Tuesday. Where do we stand with charges in this case? He's already been in court, but where does it stand?
He's only been charged so far with the shooting at the motel, assault with a deadly weapon and murder. When I spoke to Chief Dyer, he said it's probably going to be some time before they file the subsequent charges, which would likely be three more counts of murder and two more counts of assault with a deadly weapon for the people he shot at and missed. But he also insinuated that this is a complicated crime scene because of where it is and the suspect's involvement in it, so it might be some time before they actually file those charges.
Have you heard anything about any potential associates? There was the woman who he was visiting at the motel that night of the first shooting. Is there any word about any other people that might have known Muhammad or known him, maybe provided the gun? Any word on that?
Well, he is a felon, so he was not supposed to be in possession of the weapon. They don't know how he was able to acquire it. The woman, this is one of the more confusing parts of the story because the police haven't been very clear about what their relationship was or what the disrespect that Muhammad felt that he needed to kill the security guard was. But she apparently tried to cover his tracks a little bit and is now facing charges for obstructing the investigation into the initial lying about who he was and why they were there and basically just getting in their way.
Any idea when we might see some more charges in this case?
Well, you would think that with a suspect who's so remorseless and is basically confessing to everyone who will listen, that it would be pretty quick and that you wouldn't have much of a delay. So I would think relatively soon.
All right. Well, we'll follow this case and as it plays out in the legal system. Again, FM89's Jeffrey Hess talking about the murder spree that left four men dead over the last 2 weeks in Fresno and one suspect behind bars today, Corey Muhammad. Jeffrey Hess, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. The city of Arvin, south of Bakersfield in Kern County, is struggling to stay healthy. Nearly a quarter of its 20,000 residents fall below the poverty line, and surrounding Kern County has one of the highest diabetes burdens in the state. As part of an ongoing effort to get kids out of the house and active, an event last week connected Arvin middle schoolers with free bicycles. And as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, those bikes came from a somewhat surprising donor.
When George Rocha heard the announcement at school that free bikes were available for a handful of 7th graders, he knew what to do.
Get to the office as fast as I can to sign up.
He's wanted a new bike for about 2 years, ever since his old one fell apart.
I needed a bike and I kind of want something to ride to school because I don't really have anything else.
Today, George is one of about 30 students from Haven Drive Middle School in Arvin getting new bikes courtesy of the Dolores Huerta Foundation and Bike Bakersfield. Here in a parking lot outside the school, kids whiz past on pink, black, and green beach cruisers, streamers blowing, and bike bells pinging.
We're going to ride riding to a friend's house,
to a store, to a school, go get a shot at Foster King.
These bikes aren't exactly new.
Where those wire cutters come out to?
They're used, and they've been donated. Some are pretty beat up. So mechanics from the nonprofit Bike Bakersfield are on site to show the kids how to fix up their new wheels. And these bikes, they've got some unique problems. Director Adam Kaler snips a string of lights out of some rusty spokes.
So as part of the initial screening that we did of these bikes, it was a lot of stripping of fur and psychedelic colored duct tape and things like that.
And why is that?
They were at Burning Man, so the desert kind of did a number on some of them.
Burning Man, the frenetic celebration of art and community that draws 70,000 people and their bikes to the Nevada desert every August. Contrary to one of the festival's 10 guiding principles, leave no trace, these bicycles were left behind, abandoned. And now, they're being donated to a community with low incomes and high disease burden.
The purpose of this event is for the kids to have ownership of their bicycles. We're teaching them how to fix their bikes on their own, and we're also motivating them to be physically active due to so much high diabetes, obesity, and other chronic illnesses.
Elizabeth Martinez is a health policy organizer with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. She organized today's event.
We promote healthy eating, active living, right? In order for you to be healthy, you know, you gotta eat healthy, you have to, you know, be active, and a lot of the times there's barriers, especially in our little cities.
Here in Kern County, anywhere from 7 to 9% of residents have been diagnosed with diabetes, and county data show that Kern has the state's highest rate of diabetes deaths. Poverty is high too, so affording bikes can be tough. So today's event, it's for a serious cause, but it's fun too. There's music, snacks, and surprises.
Someone just popped a tire.
Respecting the environment is at the core of Burning Man, and yet hordes of bikes are left on the playa each year. The Burning Man nonprofit couldn't nail down exactly how many in time for this story, but an article from 2014 reported roughly 2,000 abandoned bikes that year alone. So just what is the attitude toward leaving bikes at Burning Man? I ask Joey Adams, a so-called burner in Fresno, who's been to the festival 5 times. She says trash is such a big deal, it has its own name.
Moop. Matter out of place. You do not leave trash. You take it with you. You bring it in, you take it out. And there is a huge community of burners that stay behind and they scour every little, you know, grain of sand for cigarette butts, for anything that's left behind.
Joey says for most burners, it's a matter of principle to not just collect their own moop, but to pack out any they find while there.
You know, if I see something in the street, you know, I stop and I pick it up and I put it in my basket and I take it home and I put it in my little trash baggie in my tent and I take it home with me.
Another friend refers to abandoning a burner bike as, quote, unforgivable moopage. Joey says, sure, it's a shame some people are so careless. But she points out, giving back, that's a huge part of Burning Man.
So that's like Burning Man happening in real life. That's cool. Awesome.
After all, gift giving and civic responsibility are some of the festival's 10 principles, too. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For a train that's supposed to be both fast and smooth, the quest to build high-speed rail in California has been anything but. Last week, the project hit another issue, the surprise announcement from the Rail Authority's CEO, Jeff Morales, that he's stepping down after 5 years on the job. Here to tell us more about what that means is the Fresno Bee's Tim Sheehan, who's been covering high-speed rail for McClatchy newspapers for years. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
A big event last week. Is this, place this in context for us. Jeff has been there for a while.
He's been there for a while.
Is this a major obstacle for the rail effort?
The Rail Authority, of course, says no, but I think it's going to be a challenge. They've been looking for a chief operating officer for a few months, and so, you know, they're being noncommittal at this point about whether or not they've got someone in that pool who may be able to step into these shoes as well as hiring a COO. But it's definitely a surprise. It came as a surprise to a lot of folks.
So 5 years ago when Jeff took over, the Rail Authority was in a similar position, much in need of a CEO. He was brought in as someone who had experience in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. How did he live up to Governor Brown's aim to get the project back on track?
Well, I think at the time that he came on 5 years ago, they were struggling at that point, because at that point they had just announced a change in the price tag from something like $46 million to about $46 billion to $98 billion, as they were working through the interim stages before Morales was hired, they were working on value engineering it back down to a more reasonable number. But that number sent a lot of sticker shock through a lot of people. And at that time, the Rail Authority was really trying to get their legs back under them. They also had a very skeletal staff, a minimal staff at that point. What Jeff was tasked with doing, along with a couple of Governor Brown's appointees to the Rail Authority board, was to get this thing jump-started through the planning stages and get it to a construction point. And that's what Jeff Morales, as well as Dan Richard, the board chairman, and Mike Rossi, one of the other board members that was a Brown appointee, have really strived to getting this thing off the drawing board and onto the construction path.
Do we know anything about why he has announced his resignation effective later this summer?
I don't. I asked him, and he played coy with me. He didn't want to talk about what led to that. My understanding, what I got out of the conversation is this was sort of his decision. It wasn't that there was some upheaval that was pushing him out the door. You never know what's going on behind the scenes, obviously, but the indication was that this has been in the works for a couple of months, working on a transition plan. They just kept a remarkably good lid on it.
So Jeff Morales was brought in by the governor as somebody who really knew Sacramento. He was a former director of Caltrans and also ran one of these companies that deals a lot in the private sector with transportation projects.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Rail Authority look for in its next CEO? Are they in a different phase now? Is it someone who's an insider, or is it somebody who has some other sort of experience?
That is a great question. I'm not exactly sure what the board's going to be looking for, whether they're going to be looking for another person who knows the ins and outs of Sacramento like Jeff Morales did, or whether they're going to look for someone who's more of a construction background. Jeff had come into this from largely an engineering and planning background, negotiating the thing to get it to the point of construction. So now it's largely a construction project, although a very slow moving one. So I think they're going to be looking for someone who can guide the construction aspect of this more so than the planning aspects, although there's still a lot of planning left to do.
There's a lot of planning left to do, a lot of construction left to do, but there is construction happening. As you drive up and down Highway 99 or throughout downtown Fresno,
mm-hmm.
you see it.
Yes.
What is slowing it down? Why is it not faster? What does the Rail Authority say? Because it seems like a few years ago they had hoped to be further along than they are right
sure.
now.
Sure. Initially, when they were initially getting the federal grants back in 2010, 2011, 2012, the idea was that they would have reached substantial completion. And of course, there's always debate about what is substantial completion? How is that defined? But the idea was that they would hope to have been at substantial completion by September 30th of 2017, because that's the strings that are tied to some of the stimulus funds that the Obama administration put toward the project. That's somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.5 or $3 billion in stimulus funds. The big thing that has really slowed it down has been the pace of property acquisition. I don't believe the Rail Authority was fully prepared for the complexity of acquiring the right-of-way that they needed and the volume of right-of-way that they need from Madera all the way down through Bakersfield. And that's been the chief stumbling block of this. It really stalled the start of major construction on the project a couple of years ago. And as a result, they put themselves really a lot farther behind the schedule than they would like to. And then there's also the reality of the money and where are they going to get the money to continue to build beyond this initial $6 billion or $6 or $7 billion chunk here in the San Joaquin Valley.
So this September 2017 deadline, it seems very hard to believe that substantial completion would be reached by that point. We have one bridge over the Fresno River in Madera County. You have work in a trench along Highway 99 and 180 in downtown Fresno, but we aren't anywhere near what somebody could call substantial completion. What happens then? Is this a real threat in terms of a deadline, or is it
it's not really, because they've managed to rejigger the grant rules with the federal government, and that has irked some of the congressional Republicans to no end. But with the realization that September 2017 was an immovable rock, so to speak, and the construction schedule itself being a hard place, what they ended up doing was negotiating with the Federal Railroad Administration to be able to use the federal share of money first and then start contributing the matching funds, whether it's Proposition 1A money from the 2008 bond measure or cap and trade money from the greenhouse gas program, to start throwing in their match later. So largely what we've seen over the last couple of years is the state spending that federal money first, because that was really the commitment that was in the grant agreements, is that federal stimulus money in particular had to be expended, committed, and out the door by September 2017, because that's when those grants expire. They also have an amount, and the number is escaping me at the moment, but Federal Railroad Administration transportation funds that don't have the same type of deadline. So their priorities are first spending the stimulus money from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, then spending, coming up with the state matches from whatever source it is. Cap and trade has been largely what it is lately, and then spending the bulk of that federal, the rest of that federal money that doesn't have the 2017 strings tied to it.
We're talking about high-speed rail with the Fresno Bee's Tim Sheehan, who's probably the leading reporter on this issue statewide. The high-speed rail CEO announced he plans to step down later this summer, Jeff Morales. A number of other issues in the news. When the Trump administration took over, it all of a sudden started talking about high-speed rail. Do we know any more about what the latest is there? Is there an effort to, or any progress on the effort to stop federal contributions or support for this?
Well, after President Trump took office and he was getting his cabinet in place, one of the things that happened is congressional Republicans here in the Valley prevailed upon the new Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao to block some money that had been negotiated with the Obama administration to help with the electrification of the Caltrain system between San Francisco and San Jose. The long-range plan for the rail authority is to share upgraded Caltrain tracks that would be electrified. Caltrain would also benefit from that because they would get rid of their diesel-driven trains and move to all-electric trains on that corridor. So once the high-speed rail trains, the electric high-speed rail trains from the Valley reach San Jose, then they would be able to share tracks and get into San Francisco. That federal grant has been put on hold by the federal government, and so that is likely to affect the long-range efforts to get the high-speed rail tracks and Caltrain itself electrified between San Francisco and San Jose.
Another roadblock is on the state level and how the state comes up with the matching money, the state share of how to pay for this thing. Mm-hmm. Cap and trade has been one source of money the governor and the legislature identified, but there's a string attached to that, and it could be going away. What's the latest on the effort to use that money for this project?
Well, and as long as cap and trade is around, for however long that's going to be, 25% of that money comes to the high-speed rail project. That's something that the legislature decided several years ago. But that 2020 expiration or sunset of cap and trade remains a question mark. So it's my understanding that Governor Brown and Democratic leaders are trying to come up with legislation to extend that. And I don't know what the terms of that are necessarily going to look like, but there is a hope on behalf of the Rail Authority and on behalf of the governor's office to be able to extend cap and trade to keep that stream of money flowing. Because without cap and trade, without that money flowing, California's high-speed rail program might come to a complete standstill because they're counting on that money in the absence of any further federal allocations.
We'll certainly be watching that. Tim, before we go, mm-hmm. people in both Kern County and Fresno County have been paying very close attention to another part of this project, and that's what community is going to get the heavy maintenance facility mm-hmm. and the thousands of jobs that supporters say will come with this operation. What's the latest on that? I remember hearing that was going to be decided sometime in the middle of this year. Is that still on track? What are you hearing?
It's going to be decided probably sometime this year. I think everybody's kind of hopeful that that's going to happen after a couple of years of playing a waiting game. But yeah, the news on that economic golden goose has been a long time coming. The High Speed Rail Authority is hoping to get what they call an early operator for the train system on board to help weigh in and advise on perhaps where might be the better place to build this facility and how to build it. So once that operator is on board and that the bids for that consultant or that contractor should be going out this summer. And that'll probably be, whether it's a 30 to 60 day bid period, and then they'll take a period of time to evaluate those bids and then make a decision on which team of consultants or which team of companies they're going to hire for that. Once that's done, then I think the Rail Authority and the winning team will probably work hand in hand to work out the logistics of what they need, what that facility should look like, and from there probably derive where it should go, whether it's in Madera County, Fresno, Kings, Tulare, or Kern. And Fresno and Kern have been the two big or noisiest movers on that program.
Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee joining us today talking about the latest in California's high-speed rail. Any idea when they'll get a new CEO?
I got the feeling from the conversation I had with Jeff Morales that it'll probably be sooner rather than later. There is a special board meeting that's scheduled this week to consider, or at least to discuss, the issue of moving forward with the CEO search. Now, whether they will have a discrete search for a CEO or whether they may pull from the pool of applicants they have for a chief operating officer is probably yet to be determined. But I would imagine that they will probably try to have someone on board before the end of the summer, if not sooner.
We'll be following that and reading Tim's coverage in the Fresno Bee and online at fresnobee.com. Fresno Bee's Tim Sheehan. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
And stay with us. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition in just a moment and hear from saxophonist Donnie McCaslin, who was a collaborator with David Bowie on the Rockstar's final album. He's coming to Bakersfield Friday night for the CSU Bakersfield Jazz Festival. That's all coming up on Valley Edition straight ahead. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. The Valley grows a whole lot of fruits and veggies, but what we don't grow here are a lot of avocados. But that could change if one researcher's test plot near Visalia proves successful. And as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, the researcher's findings could be beneficial to the citrus industry, and the growers worried about a disease moving closer and closer to the Valley.
Customers love the guacamole served tableside at El Torito in downtown Fresno so much that about half of them order it. Daniel Avalos is the general manager there. He and I just ordered some guac. For $10, the appetizer is created on a platter in front of us.
She cut the avocados in half, and then she's getting the pulp out of the avocado, putting it on the molcajete. That's where we smash the avocado and mixed with veggies.
Avalo says the restaurant goes through about 500 avocados a week, and when the chain added tableside guacamole to their menu in the 80s, it quickly became a hit.
There you go. Salud.
It's really good.
Really good.
Most of the avocados he buys are from out of the country, but he wishes California avocados were available more often.
California avocados, they're the best in the world, but, you know, we don't have them all year long.
One avocado researcher wants to change that. Mary Lou Arpaia is on a mission to find an avocado tree that can withstand the Central Valley's frosty winters and hot summers. Currently, most avocados in the state are grown in Southern California. For 40 years, Arpaia's bred avocado trees across the state for the University of California. On less than 5 acres at a citrus research center in Lemon Cove, east of Visalia, Arpaia thinks she's found 3 varieties that can do just that.
There's a void of California fruit on the market in the months of November, December, and actually early January. So if we can find different selections that maybe are unique, that fit into that window, then we help the entire California avocado industry.
Americans ate 2 billion pounds of the green fruit last year, and most of those avocados were a variety called Hass. That's 95% of all the avocados Americans consume. Hass is a variety discovered in California in the 1920s. It doesn't grow well in the valley, and the amount that's grown in the rest of the state is only available at certain times of the year. We just don't grow enough to compete with the large amount coming in from foreign markets. The goal is to breed varieties that aren't super tall, can be planted close to each other, and have a high yield. One type Arpaia and her colleague Eric Folk bred has all these traits. It's called Gem and is already sold at nurseries.
This is Gem. You can see it's sort of a little more oval or egg-shaped than Hass. It has the speckling on the skin. Now this will, as it ripens, it'll turn dark, and a lot of times this sort of speckled lentisols will get a kind of yellow-golden color.
Gem is actually the great-granddaughter of Hass. The second type is nicknamed Lunchbox for its small size. The third has no name yet, but Arpaia and folk think it holds promise.
Lunchbox, that one peels nice, but I mean, this one just falls out of the skin. Like, you just open it up and comes right out, and the skin's
It makes wonderful guacamole. I found just with a non-replicated test in my refrigerator, the fruit doesn't brown.
Arpaia says both of these varieties should be on the market within a year or two. That's good news for California avocado growers who want options.
I want our avocado varieties to be in season for more than 1 week, but I want it where you can say, oh, you know, it's July, it's time to pick this variety.
We have those premium supermarket chains that want California fruit. So if we can develop other varieties that will expand our season to a year-round or nearly year-round position, that would be fantastic.
That's Tim Spann. He's the research program director at the California Avocado Commission. The industry once funded the UC avocado research, but pulled most of their funding a few years ago to focus on pests harming avocado trees. Now he says the commission is thinking of reversing course.
In the last 6 months, there's been a lot of talk about new varieties and how some of those varieties could help us expand our market. We're talking internally now about, is it time to reinvest in the program?
John Stearns is one of the few avocado farmers in the Central Valley. He grows 25 acres of mainly Hass avocados on a hill outside of Visalia and says the incline of the hill actually helps keep the trees warm in the winter.
In the summertime, we do some cooling techniques with our emitters and some foggers and stuff like that to help cool when it gets really hot, you know, over 105 degrees.
Stern says he'd love to get his hands on avocado varieties that do well in the valley.
If they could come up with a variety that's similar to the Hass that we could plant, you know, down at ground level instead of having it on the hills, I'm sure a lot of people would plant them.
But it's not just avocado farmers that are interested in the new varieties. Valley citrus growers are looking for alternative crops thanks to a looming threat to their business. The citrus industry is afraid of a disease called Wonglong Bing, carried by tiny bugs called psyllids. It's a disease that decimated the citrus industry in Florida and has made its way to Southern California. Bob Blakely, with the trade organization California Citrus Mutual, says it's only a matter of time before it reaches the valley.
I hope it never goes that far. I hope that we're able to come up with resistant citrus varieties before we have to think about going to another crop. I'm just hopeful that the science is able to move quickly enough.
Still, Blakely admits if the disease reaches the valley, citrus growers will eventually need something else to grow. That could be avocados if the findings at the research center near Visalia prove fruitful. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. The city of Fresno has its first ever female city manager. Last week, new mayor Lee Brand selected Wilma Kwan Schechter to be his city manager, replacing Bruce Rudd, who's retiring after 4 decades working for the city, including 4 years as city manager. Kwan Schechter is an internal hire, having worked on city planning projects like the Fulton Street reconstruction. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with her about her background and what she hopes to achieve as city manager.
First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into government, what your education's like.
Okay, so I have my bachelor's from Penn State. I have my MBA from Fresno State. I have over 20 years of experience in the Fresno area. Fresno's been my home now for over 20 years, both private and public sector, from planning consulting. I worked at Caltrans for 6 years. I came on board with Mayor Ashley Swearingen in 2009, right after she was elected, as part of her downtown and community revitalization team. And 4 years ago, I was promoted to deputy city manager here at the city, last year assistant city manager, and today's announcement is city manager.
This is a job that can be a real grindhouse. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it'll involve responding to situations where the city doesn't look in a good light or we have to deliver bad news.
Right.
Why would you want to do that?
Because I feel that I can make a difference for this community. You know, I've been in the city manager's office now for 4 years, so I know what this job entails. I see the competing priorities that our city manager has to deal with, and I'm ready because my heart and soul is this community, and I'm ready to take on that challenge.
From your background, it sounds like you haven't had a whole lot of work in the front-facing side of politics. Are you nervous about having to negotiate with the city council?
No, not at all. I've been dealing with the city council. I work well with all of them. Two different mayors now, and I'm excited to continue relationship building with them and to accomplish what we're all here for, is to better the community.
Because the strife can get pretty intense sometimes on the dais.
Right, yes, but I'm fine. Yeah.
How would you describe your managerial or your governing philosophy?
So I'm very collaborative. I like to be hands-on. You know, I like to go and meet with our departments. I've been on ride-alongs with our police department. You know, behind the scenes at airport, I rode the bus last month. I really feel like I can help and serve better if I know what's happening and what our citizens are interacting with and dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. Okay. We'll see how it works out when you get tested, because you're eventually going to be tested, no doubt.
Right, absolutely. And I think in this role that I've been in, our office has been tested on many occasions, and I'm up for that.
Normally I wouldn't ask this, but the press release points it out. You're the first female city manager of the city. Do you think being female brings any qualities to the job that a male might not have?
I would just like to say about that, I am so honored to be the first female city manager of the city of Fresno. And I look at the city as being a city of opportunity. You listen to Mayor Brand's story about his upbringing on McKenzie Street, and then my upbringing that I shared earlier. I think that I'm just honored, and I don't really think female or male, I get the job done.
It's a pretty remarkable anecdote about your background with your family, that you're the first in your family not just to graduate college but to graduate high school. That's
right.
quite a rise.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm, but I owe my parents for all of it. They did a great job with what they had.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. For years, saxophonist Donnan Caslin has been the quintessential jazz musician. A virtuoso improviser, Donnie has played a vital role on the New York jazz scene for two decades, equally at home in his own small groups or as a sideman with the Maria Schneider Orchestra. The Aptos native was also largely under the radar, at least outside of the tight-knit jazz community. All that changed, though, in 2015, when the late rock star David Bowie picked McCaslin as his musical collaborator on what would become his final album, Black Star. McCaslin was more than just a guest soloist. He was a co-equal with Bowie on the art rock album. Now McCaslin has his own new CD paying tribute to Bowie, and he's coming back to Central California with a gig headlining this weekend's Bakersfield Jazz Festival, Friday night at the CSUB Amphitheater. Our own David Ouse recently spoke to McCaslin about his connection to the rock star and his trip to the Valley.
We're talking with Donnie McCaslin. Thanks for joining us today, Donnie.
Hey, David, it's a pleasure.
So, did you ever dream that you'd be working with Bowie?
I never did, and I think that's something that made it even more special for me, was something that I had never dreamt of. You know, I certainly loved his music in high school, but I mean, particularly Let's Dance, and it was just sort of part of the soundtrack of my youth, you know, and it was just an amazing experience.
As a improvising player, constantly finding your voice, finding your sound on your horn, and you're also quite a prolific composer. When did you start composing, and how have you seen kind of the arc of your compositions evolve over time along with the evolution of your improvisational voice?
Well, I really started writing music when I was in college, and it was near the end of my college experience, and it was partly from a suggestion from Gary Burton, I posed the question to him, you know, how do you find your original voice or your own voice as an improviser? You know, how do you cultivate that? And his response was that you should write songs, because then you're going to see what your musical vocabulary is, and that will kind of get you on your way. So really, that's when I started, and I've just, you know, kept at it. And I do feel like it has kind of shown me where I am at that moment. You know, sometimes it confronts you with your limitations and gives you insight in terms of what you can work on to grow your language and grow your compositional skills, which goes hand in hand with improvising for me. So I've just kind of stayed with it, and I never really took any composing classes per se, but I just learned from asking questions from people who I really admire and respect, and just kind of learning through doing it and through playing people's music. And for a while I played in Dave Douglas's band, and he's a really prolific composer, and just having an up close look at his process and his discography, or his volume of songs, was really helpful. And the same thing with Danilo Perez, and being in Maria Schneider's band for years, I've had a real intimate look at her process. So all of that has helped, and with Bowie too, you know, just seeing his songs, seeing how he put them together, all that has helped inspire me, and I've learned from all of it. So I think I still feel have this mentality of being a student, you know, and I'm still just trying to gather information that will enrich my basis for expression, whether it's improvising or composing. You know, I'm just always looking for things to add to my vocabulary in which to express myself.
You mentioned David Bowie and Maria Schneider. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to meet David Bowie and how he came to select you and your band to collaborate on his last album?
Sure, yeah. So Maria mentioned to me at one point, I guess this is in 2014, that somebody in David's camp had reached out to her about collaboration. I encouraged her to do it, you know, and I think she, you know, she had her own recording coming up, which ended up being the Thompson Fields, and that's a real intense process for her. But they, you know, she met with David, and I guess they started meeting on a somewhat regular basis to work on the song called Sue, or In a Season of Crime. And at some point along the way, I think David was trying to describe to her what he was hearing as the rhythmic underpinning to the song. And Maria said, hey, let me play you something. And she played him a record of mine called Casting for Gravity. And then she recommended that he do something with me. She mentioned it again to him, and he noticed that we were playing in town, and she said, oh yeah, well, let's go. And so she came with David to hear us play at the 55 Bar. So she had told me what was going on, and that she had recommended me and whatnot. And I just basically tried not to think about it too much. And we played the show, and I saw them there kind of out of the corner of my eye, but they were gone, you know, as soon as the set ended. So I didn't meet them that night, but it was about a week later when we had the first rehearsal for the David Maria collaboration that I met him for the first time. And that's when we talked, and he asked me for my email address, and kind of things went from there.
Having done the project with David Bowie, the album hits, and then he passes, and then you guys go on to record another album, your latest album, Beyond Now. Can you talk about the process of grieving the passing of David and influence that he had on your group for the new album?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, just a really difficult time. When he passed, you know, it was just sort of devastating emotionally and hard to process. I knew him for about a year and a half. I also really felt for, you know, his family and the people that were really close to him that, had, you know, in his inner circle who had worked with him for 30 years and 20 years, you know, who just adored him. And I think part of that was a testament to the person he was, you know, just a generous in spirit, you know, very present person, the real deal, you know, and I felt like, seeing that tight-knit bond with the folks that were close to him, you know, was a testament to who he was. And so all that was difficult. I guess it was about 3 months later we went into the studio. So prior to all that, I had written the original music for Beyond Now, and it was certainly directly inspired by the Black Star experience. I mean, a couple songs really directly from songs of David's. And then there was other influences too, things I was really into, like Aphex Twin and Kendrick Lamar and Deadmau5. All those really had an impact on the original music. And then we chose to cover a couple David songs, one of which was Warsawa, which we had started playing as a tribute to him about a couple weeks after he had passed. It was really, it was a gift to be able to have a song like that to kind of channel all this emotional stuff through, and to be able to be on the stage and have, to be able to play something like that. It felt really cathartic emotionally. So I knew I wanted to record it. And David Binney, who produced Beyond Now, has produced a lot of my records. And in fact, he was the person who initially encouraged me to do an electric record and explore electronica music. I mean, he's had a huge impact on my career. He sent over some other Bowie tunes as we were kind of having a back and forth about different ones to consider. And A Small Plot of Land was on there. And I didn't know the song at the time, didn't know that record. But I was listening to it, and it just felt like it would be a good fit for us. And then, you know, there's a Deadmau5 cover and a song by Mute Math, which is another one that David Binney sent over. So that was sort of how the material came together. And then the overarching connection to Black Star, you know, was there. And part of it was just that it deepened the relationships in the band. You know, going through an experience like that, making that record with David, it just sort of, it deepened our sense of interplay and our relationships, you know, musically and otherwise. So I felt like Beyond Now, I really wanted to chronicle that and what I felt was like the deeper connection within the band.
You're on tour with that band now, and you're bringing them to Bakersfield for the Bakersfield Jazz Festival next Friday. Yeah. So that's the same band, right?
Almost. So, you know, it's a little, you know, sometimes I have different people based on availability, but in terms of the Black Star band, it is Jason Lindner on keyboards and Tim LaFave on electric bass. Mark Giuliana can't be there next weekend, but Nate Wood will be playing drums. And Nate has been deeply connected to my project for years. He engineered Beyond Now. He mastered it, played a little bit of guitar on it. And he often is on the road with me subbing for Tim, who's in the Tedeschi Trucks band, and they tour about 10 months out of the year. Or Mark, who's also quite busy. So he's really integrated in the band and is amazing. So he'll be on drums. And we're going to have a special guest singing A Small Plot of Land, Rachel Eckroth, who's a good friend of mine, a great singer. She lives in L.A., so she's going to come up and sing that song and maybe something else with us. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, terrific. And I know our listeners are looking forward to seeing you and your band at the upcoming Bakersfield Jazz Festival. Donnie McCaslin, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Hey, David, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to being in Bakersfield next weekend.
And again, that concert is coming up this Friday night at CSUB's Amphitheater, part of the festivities going on all weekend for the Bakersfield Jazz Festival. For Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore, thanking you for joining us today, reminding you that you can find our audio archives and podcasts, including our Outdoorsy podcast, on kvpr.org, and send us an email, talk@kvpr, and tweet us @kvpr and Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, jazz host Sunday Night Jazz is David Aus, as well as audio engineer Marv Allen and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.